Agriculture and Investment Committee will come to order. Some of us had a long day and a long night, so the quicker we work through these bills, I think the more happier we'll all be. Senator Stump, you're up first. Senate File 2989. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'll try to speak up so that you can hear me. This is a change in some of the legislation that we had relating to the depredation caused by the gray wolf. And it makes a few modifications, which I think will help. Well, I'm pretty sure it will help streamline the depredation process and also take better advantage of the resource people that we have basically out in the field. And we have a growing population out there amongst the gray wolves. They're growing and then also migrating out in a larger territory. So we do have increased population. Also in my district, with the problems that we have had with TB, we have found that as the deer population has been reduced, obviously it has had an impact on the food source for the gray wolf, and so the gray wolves have moved their territories out even further. So now you have some problems in areas where we didn't have problems before. So that maybe have we can kind of run through the changes, and then if there's any questions, we'd like to address those as well.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
My name is Chairman Bruce Clayman. I represent the Minnesota State Cattlemen's Association. We're working off the A1, and I don't know if that's being distributed or folks have it. We're working off the 2989A1. This A1 is to delete everything, as you can see. This is a result of sitting down, our folks sitting down with the Department of Ag and the folks from the DNR last week and working out the agreement on how this should work. And so this should be a compromise amendment. As you can see on 1.10, fair market values are determined by the extension agent. We move down to 1.16, and this is really the guts of the change as far as we're looking at. The conservation officer was the only one that could make the on-site investigation before. We add the federal agent, who I understand works out of Grand Rapids, and then the main one for us is the peace officer from the county sheriff's. And the idea here is that the sheriff is on call somewhere in the county 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And perhaps the county or the conservation officer is not always there. And by dispatching the sheriff, we could get someone out to the site right away to take the evidence down. And that was the point of the bill. You can see then that the change of agent and conservation officer becomes the investigator for two places on 1.20 and 1.22. And then the rest of it is deleting the comments about deficiencies in the best management plan, spilling over to page A2. Mr. Chairman, that's the amendment. I understand Senator Chaudhry wants to see this next week. We made the deadline in the House, so we have no problem with that.
Senator Engelbrechtson, would you move the A1 amendment to get the bill in order?
I would, yes.
Senator Engelbrechtson moves adoption of the A1 amendment. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So now your bill should be in order. Any more testimony or any more questions from the committee? If not, Senator Engelbrechtson. I've been a long day and a long night. Moves that Senate File 2989 as amended be recommended pass, and it's asked to go to the environment. Any other discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So adopted. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members.
Thank you, members.
Senator Salzman here.
They end up paying more money.
Okay. And we'll skip down to Senator Kubley. Senate File 3103.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. Senate File 3103 comes from the Department of Veterans Affairs, and it entails a repealer for a specific veterans hospital and allows the department to move ahead with a priority list of their own.
They didn't do the back side of the board.
Commissioner Acevedo is here with me, so we'll let him say a few words, Mr. Chair.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Deputy Commissioner Gilbert Acevedo, the Minnesota Department of Veteran Affairs. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today about this bill. As the chair and the members know, that in 2007, the Minnesota Department of Veteran Affairs merged with the Veterans Homes, which were basically the governance of a 9-member volunteer board. In 2007, the Minnesota Department of Veteran Affairs, along with the Veterans Homes, had a priority list that was actually put together by the Veterans Home Board, and that list consisted of several projects. In 2008, the department went into developing a strategic plan, and right now the strategic plans are in each of the homes except for one that's finishing up right now as we speak. And part of our strategic plan is talking about how we provide care to all of our veterans at all of our homes. In 2009, a statewide study was conducted that identified various counties with possibilities of locations for future veterans' homes if the legislature and the governor's office decided to build another veterans' home. This bill basically requires the department to continue to submit the waiting list or the priority list from the Veterans Home Board of 2007. We're asking that be repealed so that the department can continue to operate with the strategic plan that is 2008 to 2013, and also have the various committees and the legislators look at the study and determine if there is another veterans home to be identified at that point, decide the location.
The bill's pretty straightforward, Senator Kubley. I don't think we need need testimony. What we're going to have to do, we'll lay it over for possible inclusion in an ominous bill that we're going to put together.
That'd be fine, Mr. Chair.
Senator Kubley moves that Senate File 3103 be laid over for possible inclusion in a big ominous bill. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? So adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Senator Salzman, are you here? Ms. Sullivan, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a pleasure to be here, and I am here with Senate File number 2941 today. And this is a bill that has come about because of some budget decisions in Washington County. The county board has, over time reduced its expenditures for the 4-H program. And after the unallotments that were made last December, the county board, gave notice to 4-H that it was entirely cutting the budget, which would be used to fund the 4-H program, specifically to fund the program staff provided by the University of Minnesota Extension program. That was really a very difficult decision. And the 4-H program in Washington County tried to work with the county board, but they also began to immediately to raise funds to be able to maintain the program. If you are not already aware, we have an excellent 4-H program in our state. The Extension Program does very, very excellent work with federal and state dollars. There's a lot of research done, excellent curriculum. As you all know, that, you know, 4-H is more than, say, like, you know, cookies and cows. There are wonderful programs within science, technology, the arts, and continue in agriculture. We have a strong a strong program there. But in order for those programs to be accessible, the county has to hire a U of M Extension Program staff person in order to implement them. And that is where we're having difficulties. And so David Olson, who is here with our 4-H leadership team, can talk a little bit about the efforts that were there. As they began to fundraise, they hit a few barriers. We had a few of our cities and townships offer to fund the program and then could not do that because of current statute. We also found that there were some, you know, program fees that they, you know, could not be used. They could not charge additional dollars to fund the educator. And so while they're going out and raising funds, they're doing fundraisers, they are talking to businesses, they're looking at, you know, charitable gambling to continue the program, this bill was an attempt to remove some of those barriers. Now, in Section 1 and Section 2, which are surcharges that could be, it was very permissive, could be charged by the state fair or county fair in order to fund 4-H, I would like to ask if someone would like to take those out of the bill for me. That would be just fine. Certainly county fairs and the state fair could put a surcharge on, but this was, you know, really permissive language. It has caused some concern with county and state fairs. One of the things that I want to make very clear is that I really don't want this bill to be perceived as a way for counties to get out of funding 4-H. However, given our budgets, given the fact that our local units of government are cutting right now, you know, 4-H programs may, you know, experience budget reductions. And how can we allow them opportunities to find other ways to fund this very, very valuable program? So perhaps, Mr. Olson, if you would like to share a little bit about the 4-H program and what you've done, that would be really helpful to the committee.
Thank you. In 2009, the Washington County Commissioners decided to eliminate all funding for 4-H programs. We were expecting a 25 or 30% cut, or maybe even 50. We were not quite expecting 100%. I am actually the executive director of the Washington County Fair, and that's my main driving force behind Kathy's efforts here and coming here looking to clarify some issues. The Washington County Fair, 75% of our buildings are occupied by 4-H activities, cooking, foods, demonstrations, the horse, cattle, sheep. They're all highlights of the fair activities. They're all well-looked, a main driving force for families to be coming to the fair to see the animals, the agricultural exhibits, and the new things that the 4-H youth are putting on. So we're quite concerned. If there's no 4-H, if 4-H dies out in Washington County, that could be the end of the Washington County Fair. It would be a very sad day for us. During the commissioner's discussion on possibly eliminating 4-H funding, a number of the cities within Washington County sent strong resolutions to the commissioners stating that they saw 4-H as a tremendous program, good for the youth, good for the local community, and very important for the county fair, and that they strongly recommended that the county commissioners find some funds for 4-H. The commissioners came back with the answer that if you think it's so important, you go ahead and fund it. Several of the cities did pass motions, did find funds. Granted, it was very small, and it wouldn't by any means would not be available enough to completely fund 4-H. But they were stopped when their city administrators let them know that there's a ruling on the books that cities cannot donate money to 4-H. So that's it's been a hurdle for us. We have worked very hard to keep the program alive. We are running on one program coordinator instead of 2, which was previous. That's a significant problem. One coordinator is not enough to keep up with a county as large and as active as Washington County. We've been able to come up with a $110,000 in fundraising activities, which is a lot of money for a small amount of, the per dollar per kid. That's a tremendous amount of money. My hat's off to our 4-H youth and our 4-H volunteers for coming up with that much money. But we're running at a bare minimum program. Unfortunately, we've also had to lose most of our low-income families have been shut out of the program. We were funding a number of over 200 youth in low-income situations, and those programs, once the county eliminated their funds, we could no longer support. So I would ask you to consider whatever you can do to help us out in this tough situation, and I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. You have another witness?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair, and this is Alex Enter, and he represents our youth leadership in Washington County.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Alex Enter, E-N-T-E-R. I'd just like to say Washington County has a 4-H program that the youth are extremely proud of. When we go to the fair, the state fair, other kids are amazed at what we've accomplished and what we go to. When we are supposed to go here, we go here. It's a standard in Washington County. We call ourselves the best of the best, and it goes along with the 4-H motto of making the best better. As we look for alternative funding, it's hard on the kids when someone says they can give you money, but then it's like there's no money. It's a setback that a lot of youth feel is not necessary. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Senator, you have a couple of corrections or something?
Right. Well, I just have one more point to make about, if there was a motion to remove Section 1 and 2, I certainly would, accept that. And under Section 3, the appropriations by our cities and townships, what's important to note is that when you are in more of a rural, community, our larger cities, our cities may provide funding for recreation programs, for, programs for youth, but within our smaller communities, such as Hugo, which was interested in donating to this program, they may not have some of those programs, and 4-H meets that need. And especially in these times when we want to make sure that, our youth have programs, are doing great things, and Alex is certainly a wonderful representative of our community, to be able to have access to those dollars would be very helpful. So this is very specific. It is just to be used to, support the county extension work. And, Mr. Chair, I know that I've had some discussions that maybe it would be appropriate for Section 3 to stay in your committee to be laid over for possible inclusion in your omnibus bill, and then to just really move Section 4 on to the Higher Education Finance Committee or to the Finance Committee. To have additional work, because this piece deals with the extension service at the University of Minnesota. The other thing I want to add here is that in Senator Rust's committee, there was some discussion generally about the bill, and might there be a provision added about maintenance of effort, so that, again, this isn't a way out for counties to fund 4-H, but instead we could work within, higher ed and also the university in our counties to, make a note that, again, counties may be looking at, budget reductions, but they need to continue to stay involved, because this is and has been a federal, state, and local program. And how do we encourage their buy-in if they're going to use these alternative funding options? So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Before we move any further, I wasn't paying enough attention. Senator Scoy had his hand up. So I'm going to recognize Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Saltzman, I too have been really concerned about 4-H over the last number of years. It's been extremely challenging for them with the reductions of extension, et cetera. Once we lose these programs, they're going to be impossible to replace. And, for a lot of folks up in my area, if we can't have 4-H animal agriculture programs in our county fair, Where are these young people that we want to be in animal agriculture going to participate and learn and get exposed to these things? You know, the county fairs, they're the feeder system to the state fair. I mean, if you don't have good, vibrant county fairs with 4-H people coming and displaying and having things that can win blue ribbons and go on to the state fair, what are you going to have at your state fair? So I'm really concerned now. I'm a little concerned about the direction we're going. If we move to these fees, I can envision a number of families that currently participate in 4-H that are going to struggle to pay the fee. And so I don't know what to do there. And I'm a little concerned about trying to move away from the county funding to a municipality in my area because they're not going to be able to support it either. So I am very sympathetic to your effort, and I'm very glad to see you making the effort. But I personally don't think we have the solution yet.
Right.
And so what we can work on, but you're right on with the – I mean, if we lose these things, they'll be gone, and we won't get them back, and the state will be much, much poorer for that.
Senator?
Yes. To that point, Mr. Chair and Senator Skoy, you're absolutely right. When we looked at this problem, and I did not note that we've been working on this since probably September, and we've met with the Extension Service from the University of Minnesota to look at this. Because this is not a funding year, we tried to find solutions that were more policy-oriented. But the discussion was the funding stream itself. And again, when we have great programs, and they're developed, and then there's sort of this gate that we can't keep open or that the local units of government have to be responsible for then funding the program staff, is there some other way to do this? And so that seemed like a discussion that we should continue as you look at, next year's budget. So that was where it felt that this year would be really hard to start, changing funding streams or who's responsible for funding what. And I know the University of Minnesota has been very helpful in this discussion. And Dee Durgan, who is with the Extension Service, cares very deeply about this program. And yet, we are one of the first counties, and we don't want to be the model for others. We'd like to encourage investment. But this is a short-term, proposal to keep this program up and running. So I appreciate your concerns. I also appreciate the fact that you understand.
And, Mr. Chair, maybe to the witness, just for my what was the savings that the county realized by eliminating their funding for this program?
It depends on how you look at it. We've slowly been cut over the last 10 years. They've been working on eliminating 4-H funding for a while, the current county commissioners. We were already at two program coordinators for the county, and we were at a county budget of around $150,000, and the 4-H youth in 2008-2009 were, I believe, fundraising $50,000 already at that point in time to keep the program alive with two county program coordinators and enough money to buy the supplies and do the activities that they wanted to do for community service. That, if you would compare that to a similar county, say Anoka or Dakota, that are reasonably similar, their budgets were in the $300,000 a year range. So we've already been doing an awful lot with very little in Washington County for a number of years.
Did I hear you say your budget, the savings to the county was $150,000?
Yes.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Chair, if I could just add, is that after the county did cut this last time, they did come back after 4-H was very successful and did fund them at $30,000 for this current year, and so they are funding the program to a degree. And so, I would like to work with the language of this bill in higher ed to talk about maintenance of effort, that they would consider at least continuing that level of funding so that there is involvement.
Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and to the witness, and I apologize, David Olson. Mr. Olson, thank you. Can you tell us a little bit about what the recent history of participation in 4-H has been in Washington County? Has it been increasing? Has it been flat?
It's been going down. Several years ago, under county cuts, we raised the participant fees considerably. I believe that's $54 per child to join now. That caused a pretty significant 10-15% drop in attendance. One child isn't too bad, but if you've got four or five children in the program, that gets to be a pretty significant financial hurdle. Also, when the county eliminated all funding, we were unable to continue to support the low-income site-based programming we had, which had over 200 youth involved. That program, unfortunately, had to be completely shut down. We were barely able to finance the one-time coordinator who could barely keep our 500 active youth going. And there was just no financial way we could keep everything going the way it was. So we are currently strong, about 500 youth in the program at the moment.
Mr. Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Senator Salzman, I'm not going to move to delete any sections of your bill, but I'm going to make a motion for you. I think there are tax ramifications to this, and I wonder if we might not want to have a little visit with the counties in the property tax division. And that would, you'd make deadlines then. So I'll move Senate File 2941. Has it been amended?
No.
To be recommended to pass and referred to the Tax Committee.
Senator Salzman?
I just want to clarify. I think it has to go to finance as well because of Section 4, Senator Scoy. So I don't know if that's a if it needs to go to finance first and then taxes.
I wonder, Senator Salzman, we should decide if you want to go there first or later.
That, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure of what would be the best route. If taxes is where you want to end up, or if you want to end up in finance, in terms of deadlines, that's my only question. It's an interest. It's a an interesting route, and I'm open to that.
Senator Salzman, I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're going to ask if you kind of step aside. Sherry Schoenfeld, who works with that group, and then we'll go further from there.
Very good.
Mr. Chair, I'll change my motion to refer this to the Finance Committee.
Yes. You have to strike those sections, please. Mr. Schoenfeld.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jerry Schoenfeld, and I do work with the Minnesota Federation of County Fairs. And the very reason that Chapter 38 has anything to do with 4-H at all is because some years ago we worked to try and promote this. Chapter 38 is the county fair chapter, and try to promote 4-H because it is, as all the discussion has been, very important to us. And we appreciate the efforts of Senator Salzman in trying to come up with some solutions. However, the bill itself, in terms of the specifics, we're concerned about and do oppose the bill as it sits without amendment about some things. First of all, we don't think it should be taken off of the county's area as such and put onto someone else. Secondly, we're concerned about the surcharges and so forth. Most of the fairs have looked at that and said, well, surcharge makes the gate receipts go down. The other thing, it's not very equal because not every fair has a tax at the gate. Some of them are free fares, but they charge in other ways, for instance, at the grandstand or with regard to parking permit fees or other kinds of things that they do these things. And so I've talked with Senator Saltzman about amending the bill to take out that section. I think the state fair has done the same, that neither one thinks that the way to go is with a surcharge and tickets. We've talked about some other ideas. I have not discussed this with Senator Saltzman, but, for instance, one of the thoughts that we've been discussing with the Federation is whether or not through the new Outdoor Cultural Heritage Act there might be some funds available for something like this. It's certainly cultural heritage as such. That's one area. Senator Scoy, you had mentioned about the property tax division. I'm not quite certain what you've got in mind, but I can tell you at one time fairs actually had a property tax levy that they could assist with things like this, but they do not anymore. And so we would ask that before this bill leaves this committee that sections 1 and 2 do come out of the bill. And we had also discussed, I discussed with Senator Saltzman about Section 3, if perhaps it might be more appropriate for Section 3 to come out of the bill here, and then if you have an omnibus ag bill, maybe that would be the appropriate place for Chapter 38 language to be to move on, because it's within the jurisdiction of this committee. And then what would be left would be the higher education stuff, which I'm not sure exactly where you would, you know, it goes to higher education and work with it there. But those are our thoughts on it, at least. And we would ask at least that Section 1 and 2 for certain be out of the bill, and would prefer that the third section, if in fact you wanted to do that, were part of the omnibus bill, as an example.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Schoenfeld, well, I don't know what my plan is yet either, but I do know that this is important, and I don't want it to die somewhere along the way. So, you know, if you want to try to fix it up, I'm okay with that. But if we don't do something, we won't have these institutions.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scoy, we are in total agreement on that.
You know, Mr. Chair and Mr. Schoenfeld, I listened to the guy from the county talk about the impact on the county budget. We make county program aid payments to counties. We do all kinds of things. It's a levy impact. It has to have a ramification on property taxes. So, you know, if you want to work on this along the way and come up with something, I don't have to see this bill, but I don't want to die either.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scoy, I don't think it's a bad idea for you to see this bill. I'm just saying that we don't think the appropriate way to pay for these things is through a surcharge on tickets. And so I don't think it's a bad idea that you consider that. It is part of that whole system.
Senator Roques.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Saltzman, thank you. It seems to me like your bill is a little bit of a canary in a mine sort of thing. I think we're starting to see big holes presenting themselves in traditional cultural heritage, you know, we can call it that, Minnesota's way of life. And it's affecting children, it's affecting senior citizens, it's affecting every one of us and every one of our committees that we're dealing with. We're getting to the point where our way of life in Minnesota is starting to fracture and break up. And I would just suggest that this year, when we're dealing with a pretty small budget challenge, that we keep in mind the next time we're all back here in a new session, we're going to be looking at, instead of a 2% cut, we're going to be looking at a 20% cut, perhaps. And so it would be helpful if everyone in this room now starts thinking about how we're going to solve this problem, because we might come up with a little fix for this right now. But it's going to be back on the table the next time we come back in a much bigger way. So we're going to have to start to look and have conversations at the Fair County Fair Board level and all the way to the state level about how are we going to pay for things that we value in this state. And I think the 4-H programming is a perfect example of how things are starting to unravel.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, just in this general discussion, if I could point out one other thing, I guess I'll put a plug in for it because it is what we're talking about here. When we are looking at the budget cuts, it's not large amounts of numbers, but, for instance, this division, this ag finance division, is what funds part of the county fairs, and you spend about a $900,000+ in your division to help fund county fairs. And this year there was a cut of $58,000 that was approved by this division. The House did not do that. The House did not make any cut in that particular area. But it might be something you want to consider along the way as you continue in the process as well, that, you know, we do need those funds. And, Mr. Chairman and Senator Sequoia, I would really be happy to talk about what property taxes could do in this area.
Any other discussion? Members, I sat through a meeting this morning, and the chairman of that committee said we should fix the bill up in our committee, not just pass it, shove it off to somebody else. So if this comes out of here, I want to be sure that that's what you want. Schoenfeld, you said if we would delete 1, 2, and 3, it would make it a better bill. We don't have to listen to you, but I will.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Saltzman and I discussed that, and I think we came to an agreement that was maybe a way to deal with that, in which it would allow you, as an example, with the one provision, you could still maintain that for an omnibus bill, perhaps, and the other one would go on to higher ed and maybe to the property tax thing. I'm not sure how you get it there, but...
Senator Saltzman?
Perhaps if it's possible to have two different routes here. Sometimes within the Education Committee, we keep something in the committee for possible inclusion, but we send the bill on as well, so there are separate ways. So I'm wondering, Mr. Chair, if Senator Sequoia would consider amending his amendment to delete Section 1 and 2, because I think there would be less controversy around the bill if those two sections were removed this year, and maybe to move on 3 and 4, but perhaps this committee would consider, number 3 in your policy bill if that appears to be a better route for that.
Mr. Chair, let me just withdraw the motion that's on the table and change that to delete Section 1 and Section 2.
Everybody understand it? Mr. Scoy moves the oral amendment. We delete Section 1 and 2. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? So adopted.
And, Mr. Chair, I would move that Senate File 2941, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to Finance. Senator Saltzman, the section that I'm going to think about seeing in taxes would be the appropriations by municipalities.
Very good. Thank you, Senator Scoy.
Okay. Everybody understand the motion? Senator Scoy, why don't you say it one more time?
I would move that Senate File 2941, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Finance Committee. And just for Senator Saltzman's information, I think that we would like to see Section 3, the appropriations by municipalities and taxes.
Thank you.
Everybody understand the motion? On the motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So adopted.
So thank you very much, Mr. Chair. It's always a pleasure to be before you.
Senator Dale, you're up next. Senator Deal, your file is Senate File 3007.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members, Senate File number 3007 is a resolution of the U.S. Congress and the President of the United States to make some adjustments in who can belong to the American Legion. This resolution had its genesis a few weeks ago, and we had testimony before our committee that there was some interest in making some changes in this area. Senator Erickson Ropes and I went ahead and had this this resolution drafted, and Mr. Tom Bodern did the wordsmithing on it. And there's a bunch of whereases here, which I don't know if I should go through and read them, but maybe I will. Whereas the American Legion was chartered by Congress on September 16, 1919, and millions of American Legion veterans have provided countless hours of service to their community, states, and nation through the Legion, and whereas Legion membership is limited because it is restricted to veterans who have served at least one day of active duty during a period of wartime defined by Congress, and whereas particular Legion posts, particularly in rural areas, have been severely affected by a reduction in membership attributable in part to the wartime service restriction, and whereas there is extensive support among Legion members for the expansion of membership in the Legion by making it available to all veterans and many otherwise ineligible veterans wish to join the Legion, and whereas the Legion leadership has refused to expand eligibility for membership in the Legion because of concerns regarding the authorization provided in the Congressional Charter, now therefore be it resolved by the legislature of the state of Minnesota that it urges the President and the Congress of the United States to amend the charter provided for the American Legion to authorize membership of all veterans in the Legion. Be it further resolved that the Secretary of State of the state of Minnesota is directed to prepare copies of this memorial and transmit it to the President of the United States, the President and the Secretary of the United States Senate, the Speaker and Clerk of the United States House of Representatives, the Chair of the Senate Committee on Veterans, the Chair of the House Committee on Veterans, Minnesota Senators and Representatives in Congress, and the National Commander of the American Legion. So that's what the resolution says, and this resolution is not universally supported. There's some opposition to it, and I think that Randy Tesdall, state adjutant of the American Legion, who's seated to my right here, I would like to make a statement as to why there's some opposition.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Randy Tesdall. I'm the Minnesota American Legion state or department adjutant, or in other words, the senior executive officer of the organization here in Minnesota. I'm here today to provide you with some facts and hopefully guidance on the issue of our organization's membership eligibility requirements and status as a wartime veterans service organization. I'm not here to speak against or in support of the resolution. I'd first of all like to make it publicly proclaim that our thanks to the state legislature for your interest in our organization. The American Legion, as stated, was founded in 1919 and is chartered through the U.S. Congress as a wartime veteran service organization. We are the world's largest veteran service organization with 2.5 million wartime members. Here in Minnesota, we also are the largest with nearly 97,000 wartime veterans, plus approximately 45,000 members of our Ladies Auxiliary and another 10,000 members of our Sons of the American Legion. As a congressionally chartered wartime veteran service organization, we are listed with the IRS as a 501c19 wartime veteran service organization. This status is important to our organization as it is one of the principles on which we were founded. Our organization's membership eligibility is based on having served honorably or being currently serving during a time of war as authorized by Congress. Congress sets the dates of wartime service, and once Congress sets or adjusts them, which has been done over the years, an example being the Vietnam dates were expanded, and when done so, the American Legion, by resolution of our organization, also expanded our eligibility dates to match. Our organization affects change through resolution process, commonly starting at the post level and moving on eventually coming to the national level to be heard and acted on as a matter of business at our national convention each year. Since 1985, with the exception of only 2 years, the issue of opening dates of eligibility has come to the national convention by resolution and each year has failed. For non-wartime veterans wishing membership in a veteran service organization, there already exists a congressionally chartered veteran service organization, and that is our brothers and sisters in the American Veterans, or AMVETS. They have national, state, and community level presence here in Minnesota as well. They are an equal with the Minnesota American Legion on the Minnesota Commander's Task Force. Please note that the American Legion in all communities allows free of charge the meeting of other veteran service organizations in any community that may not have their own local building or place to meet. All organizations, groups, and clubs have their own sets of eligibility standards. I myself, for example, cannot join the VFW as much as I would like to. Even though I served 20 years of active duty service in the United States Marine Corps, I served all around the world and even during several different periods of wartime service. However, I was never deployed into a situation that warranted me being issued a campaign medal. Nor can I join the Military Order of the Purple Heart, who obviously has its own specific guidelines for membership eligibility, as does the DAV, the Disabled American Veterans. The Marine Corps League, which I am a member of, also has its eligibility guidelines. To be a full member, you have to be, well, a Marine. They also have forms of association membership, which we also provide opportunities in other forms, such as our Sons of the American Legion, our auxiliary, and anyone can just stop by a post to volunteer. I wouldn't think of any post that would run someone off that wanted to come in and volunteer. Social and religious organizations all have their eligibility requirements as well. To be a member of the Rotary, Knights of Columbus, Elks, Moose, Eagles, Shriners, I believe all would have to fill some sort of eligibility requirement. One may say, though, well, Randy, this is just a resolution to Congress. Minnesota supports the change, and so it really doesn't change anything. It still has to come before your organization after it goes through Congress through your resolution process for a paralleling resolution from the Legion. Well, we do work closely with our congressional representatives as well as our senators on veterans issues at the federal level. If I or our leadership were asked by them if this is what we as an organization in Minnesota really wants, we could not really say yes, as we as an organization here in Minnesota have not voted on or approved this action. In that our organization is a democracy in which decisions are made by vote on resolutions, I would encourage you to seek support from a local post or any one of the 570 posts in Minnesota. One could draft and submit a resolution expanding the dates to whatever you feel is fair. The resolution, if passed at the local post, would then be sent on to the appropriate district and convention. If passed there, it would come on to our state or department convention being held in Rochester this year during July. You may also introduce this resolution to our organization at any one of those three levels. The final would be that it would be passed on to our department from our department convention onto the national convention convening in August in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Our department headquarters is right here on the Capitol Complex in the Veterans Services Building. We are always open to dialogue in relation to veterans issues, especially those that would affect our very own organization. Our full-time staff include our state or department commander, myself as the adjutant, a comptroller, a communications director, three full-time office and program specialists, as well as a veteran service officer at the VA regional office and a full-time assistant at the VA Medical Center. I stress, we'll always make ourselves available to you on veterans issues as well as those affecting our own organization. We're knowledgeable. It's what we do. Please feel free to just ask us. In closing, again, we neither support nor are we against this resolution. I'm only informing you that as an organization, we're very aware of the issue and that the issue has been addressed in our organization at all levels many times over the past several decades. Thank you for your time, and I am open for questions.
Senator Deal.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, I've passed out two pieces of paper, and I'd like to draw your attention to the one that says three reasons peacetime veterans should be eligible for American Legion membership. The first reason is that there's many veterans who served in peacetime who would like to join the American Legion and are not currently able to do so. I'd like to cite two examples. One is a dairy farmer whose farm used to be very near my farm, Lowell Anderson, and his wife Jean. He was in the service after the Korean War but didn't hit the right dates. He joined the Dassel American Legion, which was named after Paul F. Dill, my great uncle, who died during World War I. In the Paul F. Dill American Legion post, he was active for several years, and then they discovered he belonged during the wrong date, so they kicked him out. His wife was in the auxiliary, and she had to leave that. And then just this week, I was asked by the Winstead American Legion to give the Memorial Day speech there, this coming Memorial Day. And I believe Chip Gugamas is a West Point graduate. He's the one that extended the invitation. But he said he's concerned that his father, who served at the wrong time and had been mayor of Winstead for at least a couple decades, he had served during the Korean War and the Vietnam War, was not able to join the American Legion. And so there's people like that scattered all across the countryside that would like to join, including perhaps Senator Erickson Ropes, who was a veteran, and she served during the wrong time to join. So the number one reason to do this is there's a bunch of people out there that would like to join but can't because of the dates that have been selected. The second reason, and this in the same handout here, the policies that extend the wartime official wartime dates are inconsistent. Official American Legion eligibility dates often exceed actual wartime. Eligibility dates are extended so peacetime veterans are eligible to join. Removing the wartime eligibility requirements would negate inconsistencies and allow all veterans to join. Now, I'd like to draw your attention to this handout, which lists all the wars and the dates of service. And let's just start with World War I. That was a war to end all wars, and it wasn't yet known as World War I. It was the Great War, the war to end all wars, and the dates that you see there are very close to the actual dates where combat occurred. The war ended on the 11th day at 11 a.m. in the morning in 1918, and they're very close. But when you get down to World War II, we all know it started at Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941. But when did it end? The date here says December 31st, 1946. I think a more reasonable date would be September 2nd, 1945, when the Japanese surrendered on the USS Missouri. You remember this. You've seen those pictures of the Japanese surrendering on that boat. Our Governor Harold Stassen, former Governor Harold Stassen, was on that ship at the time of the surrender. Anyway, that's 16 months. The date, as you see here, December 31st, 1946, is 16 months after the Japanese surrendered. So what I'd like to know is why would somebody that served in December of 1946 be any more eligible than somebody that served in January of 1947? It's a long time after the hostilities ended. Now, the Merchant Marine category was added more recently, and their dates coincide with the World War II dates. But now you get down to the Korean War. There's no doubt that the war started June 25, 1950. That's when military action and hostilities actually started. When did it end? It really ended in July of 1953. It was a war that lasted 3 years and 1 month. But the dates that are here, January 31, 1955, was actually 19 months after the hostilities ended. So you've got people that served all around the world during that 19-month period that are eligible to join. But if you're just beyond that point and beyond 1955, January 31st, you're ineligible. The Vietnam War, these dates coincide very closely to the actual date of combat. And I really think that February, it was earlier in February when the first American casualty occurred in 1961. The war, in my mind, really ended when the North Vietnamese forces conquered Saigon and took over the nation's capital. And that occurred on the 30th of April, 1975. So this was only about a week later, so that's pretty close. I'm not going to comment on the next two, which were very short military actions. But the real clincher to me is when you get to the Gulf War and the War on Terrorism. It's identified as beginning on the 2nd of August, 1990. And actually, the invasion of Kuwait and the attack on Iraq started in January of 1991. It was a very short war, probably about a 35-day or 40-day war, very short action at that time. But that was 1991, the very beginning of 1991. But if you note here, everybody that was involved since that time, including all the war on terrorism, they're all eligible to join the American Legion. But when did the war on terror really start? Well, when was the big attack? It was 9/11/2001. We all know where we were on that day. That was 10 years after the Gulf War. So all those veterans from the Gulf War up to the time our New York City was attacked and our nation's capital was attacked by those Al-Qaeda idiots, all those soldiers are eligible to join the American Legion. It's a big 10-year period. It's a wide-open thing here that they're all eligible to join, but if you happen to serve just at the wrong time, you can't join. So to me, it's very inconsistent, and I would really like to change that. And one way to change it is if you go back to my other handout, point number 3, military service during the Cold War. Well, military service during the Cold War doesn't count. But if we did count it, it would include almost everybody. Because the Cold War began right after World War II, the Allies, which included the United States, Britain, France, and then, of course, the Soviet Union, disagreed on how to govern occupied Germany. And by 1947, the United States had formulated an official policy to prevent the Soviet Union from exporting communism to other countries. And that began the Cold War, and there was a lot of things that happened. But I'm going to bring you up to the end of the Cold War, and then I'm going to go back and talk about some things that happened, because it was cold and it was hot. Different things happened. But where does the Cold War really end? Well, one very important thing happened in 1987 when Gorbachev and Reagan got together and signed a long-range nuclear force treaty. And a few years after that, President George Bush and Gorbachev declared that the war was over, the Cold War was over at the Malta summit in December of 1989, and then the USSR just fell apart in 1991. Well, it's 44 years from the end of World War II until this treaty was signed by Bush, or this announcement was made by Bush and Gorbachev. So what happened during those years? There was all kinds of things that happened that you could call it almost a hot war. There was a Berlin blockade. We had to fly supplies into Berlin to keep that city going. We had Mao Zedong take over China, became a communist country. It was Eastern Europe that became communist. We had the war in Korea. North Korea became totally communist. We had Joe McCarthy running around telling everybody about how the Reds were going to take us over. 1956, Sputnik was launched, and we felt like we were falling behind. Also in that year, the French were defeated in Vietnam, and North Vietnam was divided off and became communist. 1959, Castro takes over Cuba. The communists are getting pretty close. There was a Cuban Missile Crisis in 1961, the Bay of Pigs invasion. Gary Powers got shot down over Russia. He was flying a spy plane. And Mr. Khrushchev came to the United Nations and took off his shoe and banged on the podium and said, "We're going to bury you. Your children will grow up under communism." And then the Vietnam War was going on. We basically lost that. Reagan went to Germany and gave that wonderful speech, and he ordered Mr. Gorbachev. He said, "Gorbachev, tear down this wall." And the wall came down soon afterwards. So there was all kinds of things going on. And I would like to say that we should list the Cold War in this list. And if you picked up the Cold War, you'd pick up everything from 1945 or 46 up until, say, 1987. And that would include just about everybody. But at any rate, what I'd like to do is get this resolution passed, send a message to the local American Legion in this state and across this nation, and say it's time to fix this. Everybody should be honored that served in the military, not just those that served during a time of war or some other time which is designated here by the U.S. Congress, which isn't even a time of war, unless you call the Cold War a war. So anyway, Mr. Chairman and members, that's my argument, and I would like to move this amendment. But before I move it completely, there is a slight adjustment I'd like Mr. Tom Bodden to tell us about. I made a slight adjustment here to try to accommodate some of the concerns that have been expressed.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Dill, just on the back, on page 2, on line 4, it seemed like the right thing to do to include the commander of the Minnesota Department of the American Legion and the recipients for this resolution. So on page 2, line 4, delete "and," and after "Legion," insert "and the commander of the Minnesota Department of the American Legion."
Members understand the motion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? So adopted. Now I'm going to ask first if there's anybody in the committee, and then I'm going to open it up if somebody from the audience would like. But the committee's first. Any question from the committee? Senator Robes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator Dill and Mr. Tesdall. I want to thank Randy for giving me a call, and we had a really good conversation about this resolution, and I respect getting some background information from you on the process that your organization goes through. And we did talk about this resolution, and I explained that I thought there might be a couple different pathways to deal with addressing membership to the American Legion, and one would be through the American Legion organization. And many of us belong to organizations where we take grassroots resolutions and they come up through the organization. And if they make it to the state level or national level, that's where the organization sits. But it's really interesting to me, and I think a powerful fact that within the organization itself, there's a lot of interest nationwide in looking at expanding membership. Now, whether or not it was able to sustain a national resolution, I think it speaks to some interest in the organization. But this resolution is a resolution from the legislature. And probably all of us have heard comments back in our district about the desire of certain veterans to be able to join. So that's why I think Senator Dill has a good resolution here. I know I hear that back in my district. People would really like the opportunity to join. We all feel we served our country, and the American Legion certainly is one of the premier veterans organizations. And although I have been a member of AMVETS, it would really be great to be a member of the American Legion as well. So I support Senator Dill's resolution.
Senator Kubla, you're next.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And Senator Dill, I guess, I don't know if you've seen the Vietnam Memorial or not, but they list the first American casualty as having occurred in 1959. So I can kind of identify with, your questioning of the dates, but I guess I've always been something of the understanding that, Vietnam was not, we never got around to declaring it a war on the congressional level. So does Congress set these dates that makes Vietnam vets eligible? Is that correct? Or Mr. Tesdall, maybe you could respond.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, thank you for that question. Yes, and I'll answer that yes, Congress does, and if I may go a little further and address that all the points made by the Senator Dill were very valid points, and they're points that have been made in relation to dates many times to Congress in arguing when those dates should be set, but the fact remains Congress sets those dates, and then the American Legion by resolution makes our eligibility based on those same dates that are as established by Congress. Again, we are a wartime veteran service organization, so once they establish those dates, we go to them. Very valid concerns. They've been brought up many times, I'm sure, nationally to Congress. Thank you.
Senator Hand, you're next.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Senator Dill and others, for bringing this up. I am a veteran, but I am reluctant to support the resolution. I think primarily... to me, it seems without the support of the organization for whom this resolution is intended to benefit, I think it's very questionable to push it forward. I am sure there are people that would like to join that at this point are not qualified. Maybe the appropriate resolution would be to petition Congress to change dates of the wars and leave the resolution be that. And if they did that, then that would automatically trigger the change in the eligibility dates on the part of the American Legion. But I'm just reluctant to say that we as a legislature ought to be pushing something that it doesn't seem that the organization itself supports. And I have just a problem with that.
Senator Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, I'm a little conflicted here because and it's probably going to surprise a few people, but I feel kind of like Senator Hand. But I'm kind of conflicted. I can go down to the American Legion, Post 54 there in Red Wing, and sit around and talk with a bunch of my buddies and all that. And we all know what goes on inside the Legion. People have a lot of fun and swap stories and all that. But everybody there is at least my age, if not older. And I don't see very many younger people, I think about some of the younger veterans that have come back. They need to belong to an organization like the American Legion. And, on the global war on terrorism, they would all fit. But there are a lot of veterans who would like to participate. And actually, you know, the American Legion, through their auxiliaries, offers a lot of opportunities for people to participate that don't fall in these guidelines. And, you know, so I know that our Legion right now in Red Wing is pretty healthy. But we just got done here about 6 years ago closing the VFW. And, you know, merging the facilities because of VFW, we just didn't have enough money to continue the operation. And even with those added members, you know, and some guys that were in the VFW, you know how it is. They don't want to join the Legion because whatever reason. And sure. We know, but whatever reason. So we saw an uptick in membership, but since then, you know, we're going to a lot more funerals than we are signing up new members. And this may be one way of getting new members because, you know, Legion sure don't need to die on the vine. They, you know, it's not only American Legion baseball, but it's all the activity that goes on for the youth. Every year, our Legion gives away money for scholarships and just all kinds of stuff directed at the youth in our community and does a valuable, valuable service. So I'm terribly conflicted. I feel like Senator Hand. I want to uphold the wishes, and obviously the, you know, the national branch voted and said, no, we kind of like to stay the way we are. So I'm kind of conflicted, but I'm probably not going to support you, Senator Dill, and that's probably like twice in 18 years now. So,
sure.
Mr. Chair, Senator Murphy, again, thank you, too, for your comments. In relation to those eligibility and the younger generation of veterans now coming out of the current conflict, we have opened, as you see, since 1990 eligibility to members. So the current conflict since 1990 has been eligible to be a part of. In addition to that, our organization has done very in-depth market penetration and research and studies nationwide. At the end of this past year, 2009, of those that are currently falling within all of these areas, the total number of veterans that are out there, in actuality, only 10% have joined the American Legion, which builds up our 2.5 million ranks nationally. Minnesota, we've done much better. Nearly 25% through 2009 have taken the opportunity from these eras to enlist. So our organization at the national level somewhat looks at that argument and says, well, we understand that there are those that think that there is a large number out there that this would really be a shot in our arm to help our membership, which we don't ever want to turn away potential membership. We don't. We are an organization that wants to grow. But the facts are that of those currently eligible, only 25% have taken the opportunity to be a part of what's already the largest veterans organization in Minnesota. So I certainly understand looking at the numbers. But they just don't hold true when we look at market penetration statistics. Thank you.
Senator Engelbretson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to ask probably a rather foolish question. I should know this, but Senator Dill or whoever, the global war on terror is just that. It's all over the world, and we're fighting it all over the world, I do believe. So am I to understand that anybody and everybody that's in this conflict now, is that what that means since 1990?
Yes.
They would all be eligible to join?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, Senator, yes.
Thank you.
Anyone who served on any one day of active duty under Title 10 orders, because there is a difference for National Guard who have not yet been activated on Title 10 orders, are eligible for enrollment into the joining.
Senator Deal.
On that point, there's about a 10-year period there between the Gulf War and the 9/11 event in New York and in the U.S. Capitol, where all those soldiers who served during basically a time of peace are eligible to join the American Legion. But then you look at the late 50s and the late 40s and the late 80s and so on. Those soldiers that served during that period of time, also a time of peace, are not eligible. And to me, that's just not fair.
Senator Murphy.
Well, Mr. Chairman, to that point, Senator Dill, I don't ever remember our country being at peace. I mean, you know, and in this regard, I see where you're going with your bill. Our country has not been at peace since I've been alive. We're always in someplace. We've got SEAL teams, recon teams, Green Beret, doing things all the time for our benefit. A lot of times that people don't know about. You know, so I understand where you're going, because even between some of these times that are listed here, Vietnam War, Lebanon, Grenada, Panama, there was a lot of pre-op work that went in to each one of these before real troops landed, before any of these dates. And I know, especially in Panama, we had fellas there well after 1990. I don't know. Congress can throw numbers around and put dates on whatever they want, but I think we as military folks know what the true score of the game is.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Murphy, that's one of the points I tried to make with this Cold War example. The Cold War really lasted about 44 years, and it picks up all kinds of events that occurred during that time. That are some are hot and some are cold, but there's conflict that our American soldiers dealt with over a 44-year period, and yet there's many spaces in there where they're not eligible to belong to the American Legion.
Any more questions from the members? If not, in the audience, if anybody would like to tell us your time. I just want to say one thing. Senator Dill's heart's in the right place. Everybody better remember that. He has. And so I look at myself, Ropes, Langsif. We all want to do what's the best for our veterans. The younger veterans now spend more time doing other things than my hometown. The big event was the American Legion. They had fish fries or meals, and now they don't have one anymore. Just three, four older gentlemen have just kind of took over in their little cafe, and I would have to check on this, but I don't think there's any new ones that are stepping forward and joining. That'll change in time, I think, because, you know, there's more troops coming back constantly, and so they will seek that to belong, to get some help. And so I signed on the bill, but I think anything we can do for veterans, I'm willing to do. So if there's any more discussion, Senator Dill?
Well, Mr. Chair, members, I move that that Senate file
3007
as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the floor.
Senator Dill moves that Senate file 3007 be recommended to pass. Senator Dill, it has to go to rules.
Okay.
Everybody understand that? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
So adopted.
Thank you.
Senator Engelbritzen.
What I foresee is when it comes before the department for resolution, then the resolution committee will take a look at it and make the decision to vote up or down, which represents the entire state, and then make a decision through the democratic process of the organization.
This way, expressed an opinion.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Shitty year for a couple guys that I know.
Work. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
One was a real good friend, too.
I have before you today, actually, for Senator Murphy, this is not a no-net gain. I mean, we're doing plates in his committee half an hour ago, and now we're actually asking to take one away. But Senate file 3026, a disabled American veteran license plate, it's before you there. I have with me the deputy commissioner that will explain exactly what's gone on here over the last, we think, about 3 years since this plate was actually put into law, and there's a problem there that
what we're finding is that nobody's actually purchased one, and they're purchasing a license plate from someplace else. So I'll let the Deputy Commissioner go from here.
Mr. Chair, members, Mike Puglisi, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Veterans Affairs. We currently have two different plates that are offered, disabled American veteran plates. One is the plate with the DAV's logo on it for the organization, which requires membership. There was another one that was introduced the same year. They were dual tracking. And as you know, usually plates that have veterans tied to them pass. And this one passed, and it probably shouldn't have. No one's come forward to request this or receive it yet. So what we'd like to do is be the first agency in the history to repeal an actual license plate. And we think Senator Murphy might be pleased with that. It's not being utilized. Nobody wants it. Nobody's come forward for it. So why keep it out there? And it's that simple.
Any questions from the members? Simply, it's a repealer is what we're doing. Okay. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So adopted. This has to go to transportation.
Mr. Chairman, can we renew that motion? Because we really don't need to see this. This should go straight to the consent calendar. Mr. Chairman, having voted on the prevailing side on Senate File 3026, I move to reconsider that vote.
Okay, Senator.
There's no House Companion.
Murphy moves that Senate
no
File
House
3026
companion.
Be recommended pass and be referred to the floor. Is that what I heard you say?
Mr. Chairman, if this bill goes to the Senate floor, I can guarantee Senator Ingebrigtsen that we can, since there is not a House companion, we can find a place to put this. Okay? And we'll get it done.
I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Everybody understand the motion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So adopted. Thank you. I will move right into Senator Scogin is here.
Do you need to move it recess for a few minutes? You need to move the bill.
Consider the motion, we got to move the bill.
She's got to move the bill.
Now the bill's before the committee.
Yeah, cool.
Once the bill is before the committee, we're going to send it to the consent calendar. Okay. See if you can pass the bill that fast.
Senator Murphy, I'm
those guys with me there.
Your motion was to reconsider.
Consider. Okay, now I'll move the bill, Mr. Chairman, to the Senate floor.
Consent calendar.
Consent calendar.
Consent calendar would be.
Okay. Everybody understand that motion now?
Yep.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So adopted. Now we have the last two, Senator Scogin and I. He might be busy, so. We're going to take a few minutes recess here until hopefully he can come from that committee up here.
We could just all vote no and
go home.
We could order pizza on the chair.
What are we doing? I said we're going to get out of here early. Let's go through. Let's listen to
I don't know what I did today, but.
Bob Fitch, Bob Meyer. Just kind of take that testimony so that we don't have to sit here for another half hour.
Is she here?
So to explain what's in her.
I did not know that. I learned something new today. Well, it's center, about like going to school. When you call recess, the kids all disappear.
Senator Hand, what
did you repeat that louder? And
now
say
hopefully I can get them back.
Say your name for them.
Senator Corey. That's a very good analogy.
What?
Putting something on the record for you.
What did you put on the record?
Members, we're coming out of recess. We're going back to work.
D for dirt and R for rat. What are we doing?
Hear testimony from witnesses before the office.
This bill that the one we're looking at is the tree care, tree trimming company's annual registration. Lynn Cheney, you and maybe Mr. Myers could, or somebody down there could start us through the process. Welcome to the committee and Tell us about the bill.
Mr. Chairman, Quinn Cheney, Policy Director at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, and I actually have Gear Friso here from our Plant Protection Division who will present the bill.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Gear Friso. I'm the Director of the Plant Protection Division. Just a little bit of background. The Minnesota Department of Agriculture, we enforce and administer a number of state and federal quarantines, and one of the areas that always has been a little bit of a problem for us has been when we've dealt with quarantines with a tree pest. So several years ago, the legislature put forward a tree registry just simply as a mechanism to allow us some way of contacting the tree care industry about regulatory issues that they should be aware of or if there's a quarantine in place. Recently, it was suggested to us that this tree care registry might be a good mechanism to serve as somewhat of a consumer protection or an advocacy mechanism for the industry. So it was suggested to create a sort of a voluntary two-level system. Previously, there was no fee for the tree care registry. It was just simply a web-based registry, and people would sign up for it. Now we are proposing to add a $25 fee to help defray just the basic administrative costs. And it's been recommended to create a higher level called a professional level. This is not a license or a certification, but someone that meets some of the criteria that are listed under 2.7 or 2.9, and these would be things such as having an associate's degree or higher in arboriculture or forestry, or if they have a certification by International Society of Arboriculture, or if they're certified by the Minnesota Nursery and Landscape Association. And we felt this was a win-win both for the department because this is sort of a way of advocating some professionalism in the industry. We would try and promote this registry on our web as a list of tree care specialists that meet certain criteria for consumers. So it's we see it as some benefit to the consumer. So I think in a nutshell, I didn't go through it in any detail line by line, but I think in a nutshell, that's describes the bill. And then we have worked with the industry, both Minnesota Shade Tree Advisory Council and also Minnesota Nursery and Landscape Association, and also we've spoken with several large tree care companies as well.
Senator Scogin, maybe you want to add a little bit to it. We're trying to.
Well, Mr. Chair, I do have an author's amendment. It's going to be real quick. It's about 16 words, and I apologize. Must be deadline day or something. I'm getting tangled up in other rooms as well. And members, I believe I'm adding words. Is that right, Ms. Cheney?
That's what I told
you. Okay. On line 2.5. After ground, we are adding and is not intended to serve as a licensing regime. Actually, I have some copies if you'd rather see it. Thank you. I'm going to hand it out. It'll still be an oral amendment. We haven't had it officially drafted, but let members take a quick look at it and would appreciate your support on it. It will give some comfort to some of those who do business in the tree trimming industry.
The author's the author's amendment, Mr. Chair, would be on 2.5. After ground, we would be adding, and is not intended to serve as a licensing regime. On 2.9, after business, it would be comma, if any, comma. On 2.15, it would be after company, it would be if any, comma. And on 2.17, after business, if any, comma. I would move that as a oral amendment.
Any question on that amendment? Not all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So adopted. Now your bill should be in order that would like it.
And I believe we've heard it. We'll stand for questions. If not, I believe Senator Chaudhry has requested that it come to the Environment Committee, if I'm not mistaken. So
I have Mr. Bob Fitch would like to say a few words. At least he's on my list if he'd come up. And anybody else in the audience would like to add a little bit to this, now is the time to come forward.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Bob Fitch. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Nursery and Landscape Association, and I will speak to the bill prior to the amendment because I haven't had a chance to review the ramifications of adding the words, if any, in here several times, so I need to take a look at that. But prior to the amendment, we very much support the bill. As you all know, when Emerald Ash Borer hit this state a year ago, it was the beginning of an environmental crisis for this state, and an environmental crisis that most of you have lived through before in the Dutch elm disease days. And this promises to be as bad or worse. And as we went through the course of last year, and at one point we asked the Department of Agriculture, who we knew that consumers were calling the Department of Agriculture looking for advice on who were the right people to hire. It was to our dismay that we discovered that they were referring people to the Tree Care Registry. And we were supporters of the Tree Care Registry. But the purpose of the Tree Care Registry was to create essentially a database of people who were doing anything with trees, all the way from stump grinding to the most technical work possible. And we thought it was important to find a way to refer the public to a more credible list. While there are many in our industry and in our association who would support full-blown licensure, we know that that is a more difficult venture to tackle and go after. And so working with the department, we identified credible industry certifications as well as credible industry qualifications such as the correct workers' comp insurance code and that type of thing. It is not meant to be licensure, and it is not meant to be to cause anybody not to be able to do the business that they're doing now. It's merely to be a guide to consumers looking for companies that have the best qualifications.
Senator Hand.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I have a question on the bill, page 2, lines 223 and 2.35. Talks about a violation, and first I'd like to get clear on what the violation is. Does this suggest that if I get asked by my neighbor to cut down a tree or two or trim some branches, am I in violation because I'm not registered with the commissioner for doing that? And secondly, what is the penalty that I, what's the, do I get fined, do I go to jail, or do I have a violation listed, but I don't know what the penalty is.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I believe this statute is covered by 18J, which is our enforcement chapter. But typically, when we become aware of individuals who are advertising tree care services, the first thing we do is just simply notify them of this requirement that they be on the registry. And so we has been fairly a low-level enforcement. We make several requests to them. About as serious as we've gone is a notice of violation. There's not been any monetary penalties or anything like that. As far as a neighbor or something doing pre-work for another neighbor, I guess I don't believe that would meet the criteria for this this registry.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hand, I would add that on page 1, line 1.12, it does identify that this is for hire. So it doesn't apply to your neighbor if your neighbor's coming over to help you trim your trees. It really only applies to someone who is hiring out their services.
Mr. Chairman.
Do you have a follow-up, Senator Hand?
Yes, just very quickly. And, Ms. Cheney, I appreciate that. It seems to me that the language on 2.234 or 2.34 and 3.5 is much more broad than that. And perhaps that needs to be wordsmithed a little bit to make it clear that you're talking about people who are subject to this registration or something, because the way it reads, you could construe that to mean that a citizen trimming his own trees would have to be on the registry. And I know that's not the intent, but I am a little concerned about having in statute things that are ambiguous. And I don't know. That's just a suggestion. I think I know what you mean to do, but I think that language is pretty broad. Just says anybody.
Senator Hand, I'm going to ask counsel to add a little bit to this.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Hand, that's a really good catch, because the way this was drafted, it looks like it could pick up additional people than they were trying to do here. What I'd recommend is after person on line 2.34, put in a comma, who is required to be registered, comma, to provide. So basically, if you're required to be registered and you're not registered, that's a violation.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Senator Scogin, do you want to incorporate that into your?
I have a question before
previous
we do
motion.
That.
Senator Scogin, yeah.
Well, I think Senator Hand makes. The issue that I was curious about when he started talking about this is, well, what happens after a storm? You get trees down all over the place, and they bring in the local logger to start cleaning up trees. It's obviously for hire. He's doing tree care and tree trimming. What does he have to do? I mean, I don't get quite where they're going with this. Is that not covered under this, or would it be?
Chairman, Senator Scoy, the way I would read this is you couldn't hire somebody who wasn't ready. If a logger was not registered, you would not be able to hire them to do that.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess Senator Scogin, I'll talk to you. I think you're going to need to work on this a little bit, because you know what happened down here when that tornado went through the southwestern part of this city. I mean, they had everybody that owned a chainsaw out there trying to clear trees up. And, you know, you don't want to get those kind of situations where you're going to have problems with the registry. And I don't know if that is called tree care or not.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scoy, the only thing I would point out is they'd have to be getting paid for that.
Yeah. Well, but they all would have been. Yeah. I mean, everybody was getting paid for their work.
Mm. Mr. Chair, there's no restriction as to who can be hired, but the statute, there's always been a requirement that if you're doing tree care or tree trimming or offering those kinds of services, that you be on the registry, and it's really just a contact for us. But there is no restriction as to who somebody hires to remove trees.
Well, Mr. Chair, I mean, we had a storm up in our country, and the tree tipped over and was going to fall on my cabin, and I called the local logger up who had a feller buncher and said, say, if I give you $200, will you come in and snip that tree so it doesn't fall on my cabin? And lo and behold, he did, and he picked it up and laid it down and carried it away. Would he have to be registered under that scenario?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scoy, if I could, anybody can continue to do their business that they that they want to do. This is a voluntary registry for people who want to be identified as tree care professionals. Now, hopefully, when your neighbor, the logger, went to cut that tree down and was taking pay for it, he was covered by workers' comp insurance code 0106, because if he wasn't, you're hiring somebody who didn't have the proper insurance. And that's part of what we're trying to identify for consumers, is that that's something this is going to make it easy for the consumers to find out what they should be looking for when they're hiring folks. And I think we all have seen when there's storms that go through, or during the worst of the Dutch elm disease days, that you get a lot of unsavory characters going door to door offering tree services. And this is a way to help consumers identify who has credentials. And I think that the workers, I mean, I'm an association executive, not an insurance specialist, but it was eye-opening to me to learn about the workers' comp insurance code on this. And that's any tree work being done above 12 feet, you have to have a certain insurance code. And it's very expensive, as it should be, because it's one of the most dangerous professions out there. So it's nothing is mandatory here. It's all voluntary.
Yeah.
We realize as an association, and I know that the department realizes, if I can speak for the discussions we've had with them, that trying to put something mandatory through is a whole other ball game, and we're not looking to put anything mandatory through. We're looking to create a voluntary consumer protection guideline.
Mr. Chairman, it's not quite right, because if you look, I mean, subdivision 1B is not mandatory, but subdivision 1A is. Mm-hmm. And then you also have the penalty for violating subdivision 1 and 1A. So that looks mandatory to me.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. There is a, for the basic level, there is a, even for an intermittent tree care company, maybe even if they just do it once or twice a year, they would still be subject to the basic registration requirement that is mandatory. I think what Bob was addressing was that professional category. That part is strictly voluntary. I would say if there was a tree storm that happened and somebody decided to get into the business and bought some chainsaws and had a pickup truck, it would be very easy for them to just log on online and become part of the basic registry and they would be fine.
And then I had one more question, Mr.
Senator Scully.
The question I had prior to Senator Hand's discussion is, what do you do with a subcontractor? I know that I had people come and do some lawn and stuff work around, you know, and there was a tree that had to have some limbs cut off of it, so they brought in somebody else. Who would be the licensee there? Would it be the person that I originally contacted to do the work, or would it be the tree trimming sub person that they brought in?
Senator, Mr. Chair, we believe whoever's actually doing the work is the most appropriate person to be in the registry. And that's really who our interest is in trying to reach those folks so that we can provide information to them should there be a need to relay regulatory or quarantine information.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you know that there are some other issues with this, the way this works, because of the dates that are in here. It seems like it would penalize somebody who registered in the middle of the year, even if they were just starting their practice. You know, because you have to register. It says you're remitted by January 7th, and then if you each month after that, you get charged an additional fee up to 10% or 10% of the fee due. And even if somebody wasn't working during that time period, it doesn't seem to allow for registration later on during the year. I'm a little concerned with the way the language reads. Plus, I do think you would want to make this effective
on January 1st of next year, because otherwise it would be effective on August 1st, and it doesn't seem like it would fit very well because of all those dates that are in there. You know, one of your options here, what you could do is just do 1B, the professional registration, and allow that to go forward with the amendments to that. Instead of amending this whole section, you could just say that section one is basically amending that section with the subdivision to read, and then it would only be the professional registration, none of the mandatory. Of course, then you can leave the existing law as it is with regard to the information that needs to be required, but not have registration. It just seems like that this needs some more thought before we're to go forward.
Well, thank you, Council. I tell you, members, I'm looking at the clock, and I know what we're going to do. We're going to be meeting next week, so let's do a little work on this, because I know there's some people come from quite a ways off about the other one. So we'll be meeting, get it together. And Senator Scogin, let's take your next bill in.
Let's lay this one on the table for some work. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for that advice.
2824.
2824 is a pretty simple bill. It is a grant program for those who do large amounts of fertilization. The equipment that does big acreages, of course, is very expensive equipment, but it is now high-tech enough where it is precision-controlled, and it is actually going to not only make our farmers more productive by saving some of their input costs by fertilizing where they need to fertilize, but this grant program will help some of these companies put these kinds of machines in place. And I do have a oral amendment on this one as well, members, let's see.
2.3. Mr. Chairman, I think
Mr. Knopf, can you
Senator
help me?
Scogin, yes. On line 2.3, delete the word general and insert clean water.
Thank you. Couldn't find it. There it is.
Everybody understand that? There's Scogin, clean water. Who's for the change? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Your bills in order that you should have it there.
I appreciate that, members and Mr. Chair, and I have people here who are willing to step to the table and tell us why this is a good idea. And I apologize again, because I have a fairly important bill to me and my district going on up in energy right now, and my phone has been vibrating, so I haven't been giving you my complete attention. But, gentlemen, I'll turn it over to them.
Welcome to the committee, and state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bill Bond, representing the Minnesota Crop Production Retailers, and I have with me two members who are in the industry, one who is with the company that manufactures these large and expensive pieces of equipment, and a professional in the area of agronomy. So if you go ahead and introduce yourselves, gentlemen.
Welcome.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Kevin Anderson. I'm from Jackson, Minnesota.
Go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. I just wanted to go ahead and give a little background of what the variable rate application of fertilizer is. Currently today in Minnesota, there are two popular methods of fertilization of N, P, and K. One is a blended fertilizer at a flat rate. That's basically taking all of the products, blending them together, and putting them over the whole field at one rate. The other option is a variable rate of multiple products in a field and changing as you go across the field of said products and rates. The blended flat rate fertilizer has worked in the past, but as we go ahead in with technology and increasing our crop yields, we've learned that different parts of the fields react differently. And using a blended rate fertilizer, we're putting the same rate on areas that have already high fertility and rates that have low fertility, so we're losing out on crop production, and we're also not being good stewards of the land by applying in that fashion. We're over-applying on areas that are already high on fertility. To do the variable rate application, we utilize a soil test, and that soil test gives us the nutrient values of the soil, along with the soil types, gives us the productivity of that land. In conjunction with the two of those, we can make a recommendation for the field where we can apply fertilizer, where we have high productivity soils and maybe low phosphorus, for instance, in those areas. We can apply the right amount of phosphorus to bring that production up in those areas. In reverse, if we have a low productive soil and it already has a high phosphorus content, we can stop the distribution of phosphorus in those areas where there's already excess levels. So the soil particles that usually take up the phosphorus aren't going to be taking that. If we overapply, they won't take that up, and thus will be left to run off with the rainwater. And so we're trying to be better stewards of the land. The companies I work for, we do about 45% of our application on variable rate. We just like to see our colleagues and our other companies that we work in conjunction with to follow suit.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Craig Jorgensen. I'm with AGCO Corporation. We are one of the manufacturers of the self-propelled variable rate application equipment that we're in question here. There's actually two major manufacturers of the self-propelled variable rate equipment. They both happen to reside in the state of Minnesota. One is AGCO Corporation, the other one is Case IH. And there's a couple manufacturers of variable rate spinner equipment as well. The major manufacturer for that is located in Iowa. Right now, there's approximately 40 units that are capable of three or more variable rate products at one time that are sold in the state of Minnesota. We see this bill as a way to increase that number to hopefully generate more of this type of procedure going on as far as spreading fertilizer. The difference in the cost for the custom applicator to purchase this type of equipment over a flat rate piece of equipment can range anywhere from $30,000 to $90,000 in excess of what the flat rate piece of equipment would cost. And we see that as a barrier as them trying to promote this type of technique. That is something that's causing it to slow in its growth across the country. We see this also as a way to not only generate more jobs from manufacturing, because there'd be more units sold that require more employees to do that job, but it's also as a way to keep more qualified individuals in the state of Minnesota, making more jobs, creating more jobs, like, for example, what Kevin's doing as a soil agronomist, people making those maps that are to produce the application so we know what rates to put on across the field. If you want to take a look at the handout here, you're seeing a couple pieces of equipment. The red one there is from Case IH. The yellow one below it is from AGCO Corporation. Both units capable of applying three or more products. Actually, equipment that's made to apply up to six different products of fertilizer at the same time. The chart there to the right of it is giving an example of four different fields. The red bar is an indication of a flat rate of fertilizer, and the green bar an indication of the amount of nitrogen put on that field in a variable rate of fertilizer. And you can see the reduction in fertilizer, and in none of these cases did we see any loss in yield. So really what it comes down to is we're looking at an opportunity to improve crop yields and also a chance to reduce the amount of fertilizer being put on, which also then relates to reduced contamination to the water, both from leaching and runoff. So we think this is a better way to help our farmers become better stewards of the soil and create more jobs in our state by doing so. Thank you.
Well, I don't farm anymore. My son does, but you go across the field. You need more here. You don't need any there. Ordinarily, you just put the same every place. So you don't get enough where you should get more. You certainly don't get enough where there isn't any. So that's going to come. It's going to come for this simple reason. Fertilizer is so expensive, you can hardly afford it, but you can't be without it either. So, Senator Hand.
Well, and Mr. Chairman, thank you. I just have a couple of questions. I want to understand what we're doing here. I'm assuming that there are businesses that apply fertilizer, and I'm assuming that most of them are using the flat rate application machinery. And what the purpose of this money is to provide, I guess, a subsidy to the people that purchase your equipment, the variable rate equipment, to make it more cost effective, I'm assuming, for a person who's buying your services. And so one question I have is, what is the difference in cost if I'm a a farmer and I want to have my fields fertilized, if I go to someone that uses your equipment versus someone who uses flat rate, what is the difference in price?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, if I may, the difference in the charges of what a custom applicator is charging right now can range anywhere from $2 to $3 an acre more for this type of service. We see that they're definitely getting a payback, but the big barrier comes, or the big challenge comes, for the custom applicator to even want to get into this business, because it does represent a larger cost for them in equipment fees, and they have to have more qualified individuals on staff, so they have more at stake there as well. And so there is an excess charge to help that offset.
Well, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for that. I was kind of assuming that the cost to do this is larger, and therefore the prices to the people using it would be higher. And so it seems as if the purpose of the grant is to buy down those costs so that you don't have to charge as high a price. And I'm skeptical a little bit of that mechanism as a way of saying if that's really economically viable, then people would be willing to pay the higher cost if the trade-off in terms of lower fertilizer usage, the product usage, would be a benefit. If it's not a benefit, then it seems like we're paying more and not really getting any benefit at all. So I'm not quite sure if I understand the logic of this. I understand it would be a great benefit to your company. I'm not sure that the flat-rate fertilizer companies would be so in favor of this, but we haven't, I assume, got anybody here from those companies. Or maybe we do. I don't know.
Senator Engelbrechtson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have a question with regards to eligible person. It says corporation, cooperative, cooperative could receive a grant. So to understand that, I mean, we have a corporate farmers going on right now, corporations. So the farmer then could apply for money from the state of Minnesota to purchase this equipment. And if he were to do that, could he actually take that equipment then? Do I understand it right? He could actually take that equipment and apply that application on the neighbor's farms too? Could he do that? Or could he do that for hire? Or do you understand where I'm going with this at all?
Mr. Chairman, I think in answer to your question, Senator Engelbrechtson, I think the intent of this legislation is to offer commercial folks that are commercial applicators the opportunity to buy the expensive variable rate application technology. That is the intent, and it has the Department of Agriculture administering this program. So they will let people apply, and they can. And if they're a corporation that commits, if you read the language, they have to certify that they're going to use the eligible equipment for at least 5,000 agricultural acres in this state each of the following 5 years. That somewhat limits folks to be commercial applicators. The intent here then is to, as I understand it, make an opportunity for folks that are wondering whether they want to go that higher level of investment in the variable rate technology to make that step so that they can indeed offer that service to farmers. I think it really is a green initiative and a job initiative for the state coming from.
Follow up, Senator Hank.
Just one question additional, Mr. Chairman, in that does the Department of Agriculture support this bill?
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Joe Martin. I serve as Assistant Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. We haven't evaluated this bill in depth. I guess at looking at it first blush, I think there's merit to it. What gives me some concern is in relation to the Clean Water Fund. As you know, we did the appropriations last year for the Clean Water Fund, so that money is basically appropriated in specific programs. So if this bill would move forward, an additional appropriation from Clean Water Fund, and I don't know if there is additional money right now in the Clean Water Fund or is going to be a bill moving. But I think there's merit to looking at this concept, but it may be more appropriate next year when we're going to do another Clean Water Fund appropriation bill.
Senator Roach, do you have a question?
Yes, Mr. Chair, and I, as you know, pinch hitting for Senator Scogin. He had to be in two places at the same time. Senator Hand, to your point about the need for grants to private business to subsidize a new venture, it seems to me that's a question we always are dealing with, you know, when you're looking at market and demand, or supply and demand. It's what comes first, the chicken or the egg. Does the demand come first and then it's followed by the market? Does the market come first and it, to meet the demand? So in this case, as many cases, you know, even with the ethanol industry, sometimes the government provides subsidies to get an industry up and running, put some legs underneath it. If it seems like it's a worthwhile venture, then they get up and running and off they go. And in terms of this variable application rate, I think we have lots of benefits across many spectrums, not only on the field for the farmer, but in terms of water quality and health issues. So this seems to me to be a good idea. Now, where Senator Scogin would like to go with the funding issue, I don't know, but that's something that we can continue to work on.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Engelbretson is first, then I'll come to you, Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe legal can help me out here, but where on here do you see any of these dollars coming out of the Clean Water Fund? Am I missing it? It says it. Oh, you changed that. I'm sorry. I stand corrected.
You know? He's got his answer.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Senator Oaks. I appreciate your comment, and I know we have done lots of things of this nature, but my understanding is that's what venture capital is all about. And the virtue of that is that people put at risk their own money with the expectation that it will be profitable. What we're doing here is we as a committee are serving as a venture capital organization, but it's not our money. We're not putting ourselves at risk. And I think that that's a very questionable thing for us to do. I know we've done it other times, and I've questioned those as well. And so my point is that I don't deny at all the value of the machinery that is being described here, but I think the marketplace should decide how valuable that is, not us. That is an economic decision that we are not qualified to make. It's the people who are using the fertilizer and purchasing the applications, and they're going to make the determination of whether the increased price is worth the value that they get. And for us to do this, I think, with public money, I really question the wisdom of that, given our past experience with ethanol and other things. So just my comment.
Senator Rose.
Mr. Chair and Senator Hand, I think it's absolutely appropriate in this case to use public money because there's a public benefit. And as we talked about earlier, the public benefit is cleaner water that we have to spend down money in other divisions, and there are health benefits. So in this case, I would argue we have a pretty clear public benefit out of this.
Senator Rove moves that Senate File 2824 as amended be recommended to pass and it will be referred to Finance. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
So adopted. Members, this is the last bill. Remember what I said earlier. We will bring up the tree trimming next time when we come up Tuesday and put your things together. So any other concerns? If not, we're adjourned.
It's just, good job.